I've thought a little bit about this, and there's only a few things that I would like to mention to you to kind of start up the discussion. And I gave it the title of new media, meaning internet and mobile phones and other types of new media, and how it could reach to new partners. And I'm going to show you that resembles a little bit what John Douglas was showing. He called it a full plate. I call it balls in the air. There's a lot that's happened since I came to the first conference. I think it was called the Grantees Conference back, I think, in the mid-80s or so. In 20 years, some people say, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I think the more things change, the more things change. And there's been a tremendous amount of change. We've seen a real sort of shift from talking about sexual disease to sexual health. I think we've been talking more about sexual health this conference than in any conference before. We talk about the shift from talking of efficacy of interventions to effectiveness, to see how things work in the real world. And for this to have impact, we have to talk about scale. We have to talk about scaling up our interventions, reaching many more people than we have in the past. We have seen a shift occur from looking at risk behaviors at the individual level to really start thinking about sexual networks. As a result, we're thinking more along the lines of structural interventions when we talk about behavior change than necessarily individual level interventions. We've seen a shift from working with traditional to non-traditional prevention partners. On the diagnostic side in the last 15 years, we've seen a tremendous change, a revolution of the way that we do testing with our nucleic acid amplification tests. We've seen tremendous change in the electronic media field, where we now have electronic medical records in our clinics in place of paper-based clinics, a paper-based charge. We have seen changes in traditional partner notification to innovative ways of doing partner treatment, EPT we've talked about, online PN. We're talking about program collaboration and service integration, and we have talked about that a great deal. We're all talking about this in the context of healthcare reform. There's many other developments. I'm just throwing these balls in the air. They are somewhat related, maybe not so related. But all of this also happens in a decreasing resources environment. And so when we have all these balls in the air, I'm thinking, how do we bring these together? And what we've done here, I think, for the last hour or so, is trying to see how they can be viewed in the context of new media and whether new media can actually can help us in connecting the dots and sort of getting where we need to go. And when I first saw KYSI's website about a little over a year ago, a year and a half ago, what I noticed was a number of things. First of all, she was talking about sexual health. And she was talking to sexual health using new media on YouTube, but also using MySpace, Twitter, Facebook, and so forth. But what really astounded me, and you've just heard this, was the enormous scale that her reach has. I mean, she reaches literally millions and millions of people. So I was really hopeful that we could rope her in as a new non-traditional prevention partner. And I think here she is, and I'm really happy that that we've come to this conclusion. Now, we have in SD prevention, I think we kind of get it. You know, the internet and all these things. And we've sort of developed our websites. This is my Denver Metro Health Clinic, SD Clinic website. And there's a website in San Francisco. And there's other good things that are happening. This is a partner notification site in Houston. This is the I Want the Kid site that that Charlotte Gatos has developed for online testing. And there's online partner notification. But if you sort of look at these things, these slides again, I'm going to show them to you. Oops, I thought I had them twice. But anyway, if you look at these, what strikes me when I think about this is that we are getting it, but we're not quite getting it. we're thinking about these online sort of interventions, and we think along the lines of old-fashioned interventions that have to be replicated. We have to sort of put them out again. We have an STD clinic site in Denver. We have an STD clinic site in San Francisco. We have a partner notification site in Houston. We have the I Want a Kids site that is available to a number of jurisdictions, but not everywhere. And the same thing is for the InSpot that has a number of states and cities and also a couple of countries. But, you know, if you compare that to Facebook, That's a different ballgame. Facebook does not have a Facebook Colorado or a Facebook Siberia or a Facebook Australia. It has Facebook, and it connects all the dots, and everybody can utilize this platform. And one thought that I would like to leave you with is maybe we can develop sort of more larger platforms that can actually be utilized in many different venues. I will give you one example that we've been involved that Rachel and Mary McFarland and Stefan Adelson have been involved in the last couple of years, and to see if we could actually sort of develop a Facebook kind of environment for workers in STD and HIV prevention, and that's the site STD Prevention Online, which is using kind of the similar kind of technology in the sense that you can basically have a site that has access or can be accessed by everybody and allows you to upload resources and utilize sort of groups and basically use the site for your particular kind of uses. So a kind of a social network site for SC prevention workers. Just an example, but I think that maybe that will sort of lead us to think about other ways in where we can actually enhance the scale that we have in prevention and not have to use a multitude of resources and duplication of efforts. And with that, I would like to close and give it back to Rachel, and you will start the discussion, I hope. Thank you.
Thanks. So we actually have a lot more time than we anticipated for questions. There's two microphones in the room. Unfortunately, there's only one microphone here, so our speakers will have to come up to respond. So if you can direct your question, that would help. Eric?
Thank you, everyone. I really appreciate this multidisciplinary session. So my name's Eric Buhaiman, University of South Florida College of Public Health, and I think I want to issue a challenge. I want to follow up on something Dr. Riedmeier said, and I think everybody on the panel, and there's going to be a question here, I promise. I think everybody on the panel brings some unique strength to the table here, and that's why you're there. So Amanda started off as being the person who has her pulse on everybody in America's use of technology, and Sally has this great program that's operating in one part of the country that's answering really important questions to people in need. And KISE is not a professional, not a degree. I would argue that you are a health educator. And my challenge to you, and this is the question, is how can you work together to help serve people in need? Because I think you're all doing things that are very important. And something that Boy Mufeng said yesterday was that we all seem to work in our own little areas and have our own control in our little areas, but we need to work more together to actually solve some of the significant problems. And I want to hear how you think you can work together to solve some of the major problems.
Somebody's going to have to come up.
Well, just for us, I know that we were very informed by the research, and we looked at the Pew Institute and other the CDC research to find out how could we reach teens if we wanted to. So I don't think that link was not, that was there. And I also, now that I know about KISE site, I give a lot of links to people when I text them back. So if you're curious about this particular thing, here's a website you can go to for more information. I use Sex Etc., Go Ask Alice, your site now that I know about it. And we just add to our list of things that we will be able to refer people to if it fits the question. So that's not as broad thinking as I think you're asking, and I think it actually prompts more thought. But that I don't think we're, disconnected now, but it would be interesting to be more connected.
And one thing to add, too, is that my colleague, Susanna Fox, who maybe some of you already know, works much more closely in the health space than I do. Her focus is on very specifically health and technology. And she and I'm here because I'm focused on adolescents and teens and young adults. But I would say that, you know, the PUNNI project is already in the health space, if not specifically in the STD prevention space. And I'll also say, and issue kind of a challenge to all of you, that one of the things that we're contemplating doing in the next year or two is a piece of research that looks at youth and health. And so if you have particular areas or arenas that you think are in need of sort of national exploration, you know, shoot me an email, let me know. Thanks.
I kind of want to answer this on a little bit broader of a scale, and that's it. One of the things I do is I help different companies, nonprofits, anything, develop their own social networks on sexuality. So if you're a nonprofit or a government worker or anything like that, my services are free. If you want to learn how to do Twitter, if you want to learn Facebook, if you want to learn how to make your YouTube page a lot more dynamic, if you want to get in touch with other YouTubers, I'm very well connected, and that's something I just do on a volunteer basis. So if you want to get in touch with me, please do after this, and I will definitely help.
I assume you thought you were busy before, just wait. Yeah. My name is Paul Gaze. I'm at the NIH and also with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And this is a great discussion. And actually, what I want to ask about builds on the last comment about working together. And I'm thinking comprehensively, as we all need to do, with these discussions about improving science and technology applications. Are there discussions taking place about quality assurance, unintended consequences? Sally obviously highlighted that she receives sensitive questions at sensitive times for people who are in sensitive times of their lives. The questions, are they being discussed? What are the qualifications of the responders? Are there quality checks on the staff and the responses that are going out for accuracy, for emotional sensitivity, etc.? Sally is the Public Health Coalition, but is there discussions around having these approaches even hijacked by groups that may have a different agenda or a different approach, such as religious zealot groups that have a certain position that they're trying to promote, or commercial interests that are trying to push through certain services or products? It really is not in necessarily an honest public health intent. I open the floor to your responses. Thank you.
Anyone?
I can answer this first part. So, the first part in terms of monitoring, because it is this, we do get a lot of sensitive information, and you have to be very careful. I think when we started, as part of the protocols, and I didn't get too much into it, is that we need to check and recheck the types of questions we're getting, but more importantly, the types of information we're sending out. We very often, if it's a delicate topic, just in our work, we will check it by with a colleague and say, does this sound sensitive enough? Is this emotionally in tune enough? Is this delicate enough? Is it accurate? Is it, so we do check that. It's one of our biggest priorities. I mean, sometimes it's almost that much more time consuming because we really, I mean, I'm almost careful with every word. So it adds to the, you know, there is a tremendous responsibility with this. I think that's the key. And in terms of the other part, it could get into bad hands. I think that's true, but I don't know how you would monitor it. I mean, the internet is an open society, it almost takes just your own good morals and ethics to proceed delicately. But so we're very conscious of that, and that's what I'll say about what we do.
I think the key with what I do is to make sure that every time I answer a question, there's always information at the beginning, that they know that I'm not a medical professional, don't have a degree in it, and that what they're asking is a peer to respond. I make sure that the information I give out is from very credible sources, but when they ask me a question, I always make sure they're aware of who they're getting that response from. That's kind of my quality control on that. And whenever I do have a question, my parents are in the medical field, and they get a lot of phone calls from me going, is this right? Am I on the right line here? So thank you, Mom and Dad.
My question was more for Amanda and Brian Nixon in Indianapolis. Like, the information you presented was amazing. I loved it, and I thank you very much for coming to present that. I've never been able to see anybody pull up together. How can we access that information? And then you also mentioned about not breaking down into, like, different minority groups. Do you guys have specific information on maybe, like, MSM or young MSM and compare that, or any plans to look at that in the future? Because I know, like, MSM access the internet totally different, and especially young MSM, than maybe the heterosexual counterparts.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first, we don't ask about sexual orientation at this point. If we do go forward with a health study, I would imagine that that may be something we'll ask. It's not something that the Pew Research Center, which is the umbrella org, has ever done, as far as I know, but I think it's absolutely worth considering, particularly if we're going to be asking questions about sexual health information seeking or anything of that nature. As for availability, all of this data is available on our website. It's also, the data sets are downloadable, so if you use SPSS, you can access the data sets. The 2009 youth data set is not available yet because we're still writing a last piece off of it. That piece will hopefully come out in the next 2 months. It's going to be on youth and cell phones. I commend it to you. I think it will be very interesting. It will go into much more depth on the things that I talked about today for youth 12 to 17. And once that is released, the data set will be released immediately after that, and it's accessible to anyone. Some of the data analysis that I presented is analysis that I did specifically for this talk or have done for a couple of other talks I've given in the past couple of weeks. So that is not necessarily available outside of slides. But given the interest, what I may do is try to pull it together in what we call a commentary, which would be a short, very more informal piece, but would be something you could point to and a place to go to grab that information. So, our website is www.pewinternet, so that's all one word, .org. And all of this stuff is available there, and so I would highly recommend. And it's all free. We make it available to anybody who wants it.
And can I just also add, you can sign up on their website, and you'll get updates when new reports come out.
Yes.
I'm going to stay on this side of the room because you were there first.
Okay. My name is Max Mahana. I'm actually out of Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, for exposure corporate. We're a CBO out there. My question for Kaisen, I'm just blown away by your numbers. I'm one of those people that YouTube is a part of my daily life. I literally check my email, check my Facebook, then I check my YouTube. My question for you is, have you made any efforts in narrowing down? I understand you said it's all anonymous and you get comments from everywhere. Have you made any efforts in narrowing down demographics, like asking them, would you put your city and state where you are, if you're male or female, or are you requesting any information to kind of narrow it down to exactly who you are reaching? And if you haven't, do you plan on doing that?
What I do have is the ages and the gender, and of course just where I am and I'm not viewed, which is, again, every state. Part of the problem I have with that is when I do request it, it's those who want to respond. So, but what YouTube does have is called YouTube Insight. So what I am able to do is actually go and access exactly who is viewing it, in what state, what percentage of my viewers are from that state, and that kind of thing. And that's just, I mean, that's something I can export easily through YouTube. And I think that the only problem with that is that I would say, just throwing a number out there, probably 30% of YouTubers, when they sign up for their account, don't tell the truth on their age or location for anonymity. So, that's probably the best way to get it is through Insight, but and if you're interested in that, I can definitely get you that information. So if you just give me your email address, I will send that to you.
This question is mostly for Kaisen, also Sally to some extent. We've been talking a lot about the information that you're providing and the scale of your audience. But and you mentioned just a moment ago that you have try to use very credible sources. I'm curious as to what those sources are. Is it like Wikipedia, or is it NIH? I mean, where are you getting this information? One of the issues, I think, and my main concern, is that if you get something wrong, you're getting it wrong for 12 million people. And that's something that the San Francisco City Clinic isn't doing, because if they get something wrong, they've got a much smaller world, and they're also being vetted constantly by an entire slate of public health professionals, not their doctor parents. So I'm curious as to how far you vet these questions, or vet the answers before you respond.
Okay, when it comes to videos, the criteria I go by for what sources I use is it has to be a journal article published within the last 5 years that's peer-reviewed. And I really stick to probably 20 different journals and try not to veer off into the smaller ones. So that's where I gain, that's what I call credible sources. That's my qualification, not Wikipedia. In fact, I actually get a lot of viewers who say, you're wrong, because Wikipedia says. And especially on my video, does size matter? Everyone wants to argue with me on that because of that. So it's that. And then when people write to me, if they ask for specific information, that's what I tell them to do. I tell them to look up the information. I don't go out there and just give them information, because I think that if they come to me and they ask me a simple question and I just give them the answer, they might appreciate that. If they go out there and they look for it themselves, they're going to own it. So that's kind of how I try and respond, especially because of the mass amount of emails I respond to.
Yeah. Then a follow-up.
Yeah, what was that?
If you're telling them where to go, do you say, look at this journal? Do you include any sources in your videos or anything else where you say, go out and look for yourself, only information so that they can go to Wikipedia and discover?
I'll go and typically find a website, a government website, or I will quote, or I'll let them know where they can go and read a journal article, something they can't access, because obviously I have a lot more access to journal articles than someone else. They can't just go out there and read most journals. So whenever I do forward them to something, it's a government website, typically.
How do you deal with alternative questions that are outside your purview, like LGBTQ questions, questions that you might feel uncomfortable answering? Like, at what point do you say this is something that we can't discuss?
A lot of questions, I don't know if this is quite what you mean, a lot of them are personal, a lot of them are inappropriate, and I tell them. I think it's important that someone does, you know, especially if they're younger, early on, say that's an inappropriate question, and just to let them know that. If it's something that I just don't know at all, and especially if it's someone I feel needs professional help, because I get a lot of people who have probably psychiatric problems, mild or severe, I let them know I'm not a professional. However, I am sure that there are many professionals in your area, and I often encourage them that there are also free clinics, that money's not an issue, that they need to go out and find that information, and to take ownership of their life like that.
Good afternoon. My name is Rachel Fletcher, and I'm from the School of Public Health in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. And this question is for all of you and also for the audience. One of the things that I'm really interested in with technology and the move towards using this as a primary tool in public health research is how we can take a hold of technology to address some of the persistent disparities that exist in public health. And the challenge that I see, and perhaps others have more ideas, but one of the challenges is this whole positive pro of anonymity presents a very large challenge of identifying whether or not we're actually reaching people who are in our target populations, who make up the disparities that we're trying to overcome. So I'm wondering how you envision approaching that in a way that We can demonstrate to our funders, we can demonstrate to our peers in the research community that we're actually making a change in the groups of people that we care about making changes. Come on.
I think that's a real challenge in the digital world. Because verifying anyone's identity with any sort of certainty is nearly impossible unless you'd like to use biometric data, and I don't really think Americans are behind that. It's really it's a challenge for policymakers on a bunch of different issues, and I usually hear about it in the online safety realm. You know, how can we confirm that this person's an adult, this person's a young person? How can we confirm anything about somebody? So it's actually, you're almost always going to have to rely on self-report for anything that involves kind of a digital interaction with a person. So there's always going to be, as you know, Kaisi mentioned, you know, oh, well, I have all these 16-year-olds who respond to me, but they could be 14, they could be 12, they could be 35. People play with their identity online. It's actually a fun part of internet experience for a lot of people. Less so in places like Facebook, where your identity is much more clearly pinned to your offline identity. But in places like MySpace and other kinds of spaces, identity play is par for the course. And so, I'm not going to touch on issues around anonymity and sort of health privacy, because that's not my area of expertise, other than knowing that it exists and it's an issue. But in terms of verifying identity in a digital space, it's a real challenge, and I think you're never going to get the amount. It's always going to have to be with a grain of salt. It's in similar ways to sort of telephone polling, where we ask people about their race and their ethnicity and their identity. We can cross-check it with things that we know from the census, where somebody came and knocked on the door of somebody in that precinct and, you know, said something about this area, but we don't know for certain that the person that we're reaching fits the particular characteristics other than what they tell us. So there's a lot of self-report and research. It's just a question of what level of kind of uncertainty are you okay with.
My name is Sarah Goldenkrantz, and I'm from the Center for Health Training in Seattle. My question was about turnaround time. I feel like a lot of young people are starting to use this type of technology, not just because it's easy, but also because it's relatively instant. And those of us that work for smaller health organizations are definitely interested in it, but I think there's a lot of fear about not being able to keep up. And so I especially Sally mentioned that you do a lot of your responses very nicely and weekends, and I'm just curious, how long do you feel is this a great turnaround time so that you're not.
That's a good question. What we advertise is that we'll get back to you within 24 hours, and that seems to be a decent amount of time to give us time to answer. Although it can be pressing sometimes when you're really super busy and you do have to take it home at night. We do pass it around. We'll either go by week or 2 weeks to 2 weeks. We have about 7 people who answer the line, so usually that kind of keeps it a fairly light load, and we say 24 hours. It's sometimes much quicker than that, but sometimes they'll text at midnight or 2 a.m, and those aren't my hours when it's with me. But so some reasonable time after that we try to get back. But you're absolutely right. It is a resource pull, and we've thought about that a lot in terms of how. Doing more outreach and getting to more of the youth around the state, how we will man that. And I think we're kind of hoping for some funding so we can hire a full-time person to coordinate. We'd still probably take some turns, but that's a good question and one we're kind of struggling with now. But in general, if the questions are, say, and it's certainly not the scale of Kaisi's work, but we will get maybe 10 questions a day, and that's manageable. If it's 100 questions a day or 200 questions a day, and after our newspaper article, it was that many, and we were just slammed, overwhelmed. It was all we were doing, and that was not sustainable. So at 10 a day, it's pretty sustainable.
I would say that the key is finding someone to do the job who lives the internet. If people can tweet 30, 40, 50 times a day, that's the kind of person you want responding. I tried to get my mom, who is a sexual assault nurse examiner, to start a YouTube page, and she couldn't get past all the questions. And the questions were only about, I don't know, 10 a month, but it's too many for her. Whereas if you find someone else who's just driven on the internet, you don't find quite that same problem. So if you find people within your organization, and according to the numbers, it seems those are younger adults, if you find people like that, I don't think you're going to quite have a problem with it.
My name's Ray Perry from UCLA. I guess the question I have is, we're reaching a lot of people, which is great for all the different services that we're offering, but what about people that aren't actively seeking information? Because I think there's still millions of teens and young adults that could benefit and that need this information, but aren't going for it actively. And so we need to find a way to get in touch with them too, and make sure they're getting the right information. So if you guys have any suggestions on how to use what you're doing, what reach our large audience.
I mean, I think there are still plenty of ways to reach people in those spaces where they are, particularly on the social networks. While users tend to resent poorly targeted advertising, there is some suggestion that they are okay with well-targeted advertising, and that's a way that you and everybody else who's competing for a little bit of that attention economy is trying to reach them. So you're in a competitive marketplace with your message, but that doesn't mean that there aren't ways to put it out there mostly through advertising channels on these social networking spaces in particular. To reach people. I would not try to reach people through cell phones. There are advertisements that you can do that way, but I would, if your population is a cell phone oriented population, I would probably consider more hard media initially by putting posters and billboards and things that they're going to visually see that are not digital to direct them to information they can access with their phone. So it may be directing them to a digital space or place, but where they will encounter the material initially visually and in real life.
I'm not black and white county. So thank you all for these very interesting presentations. I have actually a lot of questions, but I was really fascinated with Case's question at the end about why we're doing these balkanized kind of use of a global universal medium. And I'm trying to frame this as a question, but I think, you know, we were like the second InSpot site for partner notification. I think ISIS is now moving to some kind of national model, which makes sense for partner notification, where you would have people have a partner in place and that partner could look up local things. But all the things that we think of as universal on the internet are conduits, right? And one of the problems that we have as agencies is how are we going to manage the content? So how are we going to reach specific audiences without other advertising? So just one example also for InSpot, one of the things that we had as an issue that would have been a problem joining this larger, you know, global kind of InSpot is how are they going to handle HIV? We had HIV as a part of the drop-down menu like all the rest of these. Would other jurisdictions had a separate page for HIV to handle it differently? So I guess I kind of want to ask you, kind of put your question back to you and say, given that we are not just conduits, but we're also making policy decisions and content decisions, and we see, you know, very disparate kinds of tolerances for messages around the country, how can we do a better job having, you know, sharing this technology? For example, we have a home testing program in LA we kind of make available on national scale or state scale, but there are people with issues and understanding that.
Just to give you an example, and maybe that would make sense. For example, our STD clinic, your STD clinic, the San Francisco STD clinic, we have, or had, I should say, the resources to put these sites together. There are many STD clinics in the country, much smaller, that don't have resources to do this. They would love to have something like this, but they cannot do it because they don't have the resource to replicate the technology and so forth. I'm just thinking that if we had, and a lot of these sites are actually replicating each other because all these sites have some pages about gonorrhea, chlamydia, trichomoniasis, and syphilis, and they're all trying to reinvent the wheel. I think that you can basically set up a basic technology that that has all this information, which is probably about 80% or 90% that you need for a site like this. And then you can so-called, you know, there's this term called skinning, where you, it's not skinning a cat, it's basically putting a skin onto a site. And you could sort of say, okay, this is, you know, Monroe County STD clinic, and you basically have your identity with your opening hours and maybe some additional information, but basically it draws 90% of its information from the platform that can be uniform across. I'm just an example on how we can share this type of technology. Of course, somebody's got to pony up the dollars to do this, but I think it can be done.
Well, if I can just tell you, it's actually ponying up the dollars. I mean, support that idea, I think it would be great in various forms here, but it's not just pointing out the dollars to put together the site to begin with. It's also, we were just hearing in North Carolina, like, how many messages can you respond to in your swamp? The people who are answering locally, you only have so many staff to respond. And are they filling the needs of their locality? Are they filling other needs in one locality? Like, how do you distribute that effort? We're not just a conduit for us. Delivery service. Dan, I'm just saying, if like that's part of the thing that we're negotiating, just to give you an example from the home test kit, we were trying to do exactly what you just said. It's like, say, we've already done the work, we've already paid for the upfront programming, you can rescan, you can use our advertising, make it easy for you to borrow and replicate, and you can actually go through in California, go through our site. But then the question was, who's going to process the kids? We can't process the kids for Sacramento.
Right.
You know, we're processing LA County kids.
Right.
So,
well,
we've
had
the results, you know.
Charlotte Gaitis and I have had this discussion many times because she's trying to replicate her I Want the Kid for Baltimore. And I doubt that Charlotte wants to process sort of all the specimens in the U.S. But technically, when you think about it, whether I ship my kit to Quest in Denver or to Hopkins in Baltimore or wherever the laboratories are, you know, technically, it doesn't make a difference. And so, it's basically trying to get the minds together. I mean, in my view, it's easy to say probably, but, you know, you can think about this in a central, decentralized kind of way. And I don't think we're quite there yet.
No, but we're having this conversation.
Yeah, but we're going there.
Thank you.
All right, we're out of time. If we can give our speakers another round of applause.